Our next guest is a resident senior fellow with the Atlantic Council's Brent Scowcroft Center for Strategy and Security. And she is a Middle East policy expert. And she is a Drive Hall of Famer. And it's great to have her on live from Istanbul. She is Jasmine El Gamal. Jasmine, hi.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me on again.
It's our pleasure. What is it, like 1:30 in the morning or something there?
1:45.
Wow.
Close enough.
Well, we appreciate you doing this. We saw you on CNN yesterday. I guess you're going to be on again with Aaron Burnett today.
You know, they just actually canceled it because they have some impeachment-related news that they're going to cover today. So I got a bit of a respite.
Oh, good. You get to sleep.
A little bit.
Yeah. Now, you were born in New York, but raised in Egypt. Talk a bit about that.
Yeah, so my dad actually immigrated from Egypt to the U.S. in his 20s. And when I was born in New York. When I was around 5, he decided that he wanted us to really learn the language and the culture and where we came from. He was sort of very big on knowing, you know, your roots. Even though we were Americans, he wanted us to know where our family came from. And so he decided to move us there. And his deal was that we had to finish high school in Egypt, and then we could decide whether or not we wanted to come back to the U.S. So that's what I did. I finished high school and, of course, decided to come right back to the U.S. after that.
And how did you wind up in Istanbul?
You know, I was at the Department of Defense for about 8 years as a civil servant. I worked as a Middle East advisor right out of grad school. And I think, you know, at some point I realized that so I did 2 years of grad school in DC and then 8 years at DOD. And after that time, I realized that I was becoming really, I just felt really disconnected from the issues that I was supposed to be advising on. And, you know, I mean, DC is such a bubble, and yeah, it's so easy to think that the world revolves around you and around the U.S. when you're there. And I wanted to just come back to the region and reconnect and understand what was happening here from people's perspective here so that I could better kind of relate that to folks in the U.S. and vice versa.
Well, you've done a great job doing that.
Thank you.
What do you think's next for the U.S. and Iran at this point? Where are we going with this thing?
So, you know, Steve, I don't think anybody has the answer to that question. I would be really wary of anyone who tells you that they do have the answer to that question. But let me lay out a couple of points I think that are worth considering. First of all, the U.S. strike on Qasem Soleimani was such a shocking, unexpected move that I think it just sort of took the game to a whole new level.
Right.
A couple of things have come out of that strike. The first is that Iran now most likely feels like it absolutely has to retaliate in some way in order to save face in front of its own people. There's no way that they're going to let this go without doing something. Now, I don't think, and I've said this before, neither the U.S. nor Iran want a full-blown war.
Right.
So I don't see Iran doing something so incredibly egregious. It's not like they're going to come assassinate one of our top officials. Do you know what I mean? I don't think they're going to do that. But they are going to have to do something to save face. And that could mean a variety of different things. It could mean, you know, the U.S. has about 50,000 troops across the region. We have troops in Syria. We have troops in Bahrain and Qatar and Saudi Arabia and Iraq, obviously. There are a variety of targets that the Iranians can strike just to say that they were able to retaliate. So that's one thing that we have to keep an eye out for. And the other thing is, what are the consequences of that? One thing that has it's one of the first things that kind of fell victim to this was the U.S.-led coalition to defeat ISIS in Iraq. So you know that we have a coalition of the U.S. and Western forces that are in Iraq that have been there since about 2014 to fight ISIS. Now, they are so worried about the potential for an Iranian retaliation right now that they've suspended operations in Iraq to fight ISIS just to, like, to make sure that they're covering their bases and prepared for any sort of attack. So the fight against ISIS has fallen victim to this conflict with Iran. And we don't know what might come next. I mean, the one thing that I will say that has been incredibly unhelpful I was watching today the Iraqi prime minister. He's the outgoing prime minister. Mm-hmm. He held a cabinet meeting, and it was streamed on the internet. And he was just so visibly frustrated at the fact that he just simply doesn't know what the U.S. wants, what it wants to do, what its plans are, why it's doing what it's doing, and just really frustrated at the fact that Iraq, who has no, you know, kind of nothing to do with this, is caught in between the struggle between Iran and the U.S. Mm-hmm. and can't really do much about it. So that's, you know, one thing that this has done is it's really strained our relationship with Iraq, you know, for no real good reason, and has made our European allies kind of throw their hands up in frustration and just say, what are you guys doing?
Do you think there might be some attempt at diplomacy between the U.S. and Iran?
So, Steve, that's an excellent question, and it's the question that everybody's asking right now. Is there a chance for diplomacy?
Yeah.
I'll say a couple of things about that. The first is that the U.S. and Iran don't have any direct communications at this point, right? They don't talk to each other.
Right.
So the prospect for diplomacy obviously diminishes when you don't have the ability to pick up the phone to your counterpart and say, hey, enough of this nonsense. Like, let's get back to the negotiating table. You'll remember that in 2016, I gave this example a couple of days ago. Right before the Iranian nuclear deal was about to be implemented, 10 U.S. Navy sailors by mistake went into Iranian territorial waters and were captured by the IRGC. And that could have been huge. It could have escalated. It could have scuttled the deal. It could have done a million things. But because at the time, Secretary Kerry and his counterpart, Zarif, in Iran had direct communications, they were able to pick up the phone, talk to each other, and within 24 hours, those soldiers were released. So you have to ask yourself, well, if this happened today with no direct communications, what would happen? So that's not a good sign for the prospects of direct diplomacy. My guess is that Iran will have to do something to retaliate, to save face, and then maybe only after that, either our European allies or Saudi Arabia, or even Putin at this point, who's been just shuttling around the region. He was in Syria yesterday talking to President Assad. Tomorrow he's going to be in Turkey talking to President Erdogan. And then next week, Chancellor Merkel is going to be in Moscow talking to Putin. So he's doing his fair bit of diplomacy to sort of project himself as the adult in the room. I think that, you know, at some point we do hope that things will de-escalate. But in the meantime, nobody really knows what's going on, and everybody's just kind of hoping for the best but preparing for the worst.
Our good friend, Drive Hall of Famer and Middle East expert, Jasmine El Gamal, is with us. And here, Mike's got a question for you.
Okay.
Do countries like Iran and Iraq, is there any separation in the way they feel about America specifically and Trump? The American diplomacy and Trump diplomacy, or do they see them as one and the same?
So, okay, thanks for that question, Mike, because I think that that's something that people have kind of gotten wrong over the last few days as they've tried to kind of opine about this, in whether it's on Twitter or on the press or anything like that. I mean, the real but unsatisfying answer is that there is no such thing as this is how Iran feels and this is how Iraq feels. Some people in Iran feel aggrieved that Soleimani was killed, because they supported him. Some people don't support him at all, but they feel angry that the U.S. just violated their sovereignty like that by killing one of their top leaders, even if they hated him. Some people have suffered at his hands and so find this to be good news. Same thing for Iraqis. If you look at the Iraqi parliamentary vote from a couple of days ago that asked the U.S. to leave Iraq, the vote was barely, the parliamentary session was barely at quorum. All of the Sunni and Kurdish MPs boycotted that session. So you can't even say that that was a full-fledged representative request for U.S. troops to leave. So I would just say it's much more complicated than just saying either Iran or Iraq want this or support that or the other. I would highly recommend for your visitors. I mean, if I'll just plug my Twitter feed only because I have shared lists over the last few days of Iraqis and Iranians, both scholars and activists, people who work on the region and live on the in the region. And if your listeners want to learn more about Iran and Iraq, they can check out my timeline at Jasmine El Gamal on Twitter, and they could find those Iraqis and Iranians and just hear straight from them.
It's El-Gamal. Live from Istanbul, Jasmine, bless you, and thank you so much for staying up late and taking the time with
Thanks
us.
Thanks so much, guys. I appreciate it. Okay. It was good talking to you.
All right. We'll talk soon.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Take care.